Look at this shit. Pork again. Man, won't you let me have that turkey loaf for this pork shit, man? Just today, I can't eat this shit, Harold.
What you been smoking, Junior?
Shut up! Shut up and take the pain. Take the pain!
To find your needed award. To me, it's what we do when we're bored. I feel the heat coming off of the blacktop, and it makes me want it more. Because I'm hyped up out of control. If it's a fight, I'm ready to go. I wouldn't put my money on the other guy if you know what I don't matter.
What's happening, everybody? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Got a good show for you today. Got a hot one. You get it? I'm going to be talking about my experience eating the Dynamite Challenge at Gelato Restaurant with Peter and Joe. That's coming up a little later. Also, another installment of Eat It Before It Eats You. I realized, man, I have not done one of these since I did the first one. So I need to get off my ass. Music from Sick Puppies. You can download that song. You're Going Down. From the iTunes store, just follow the link on our website, take you right to it. Sean Paxton, the homebrew chef, he turned me on to this interesting show on Planet Green called Big Chef Takes on Little Chef. And it's a three-part series from BBC that followed Heston Blumenthal of Fat Duck in England as he tries to save this restaurant chain in England called Little Chef, who's having financial problems and they're about to go under. Little Chef, it almost seems like Denny's, but in England. And Blumenthal went in there. He retooled the menu, used fresh local ingredients, made the restaurant look a little more modern, trained the staff to be more professional, and try to make the dining experience a little better for the customers. And it's really interesting how they did this. Three parts, right? And I think I caught it too late because they only showed parts two and three. And now they're not showing it at all, so maybe it'll come back. I never caught the first episode, so I have to keep my eyes on it. It was really great to watch. And if you guys get Planet Green on your cable lineup, check it out. If this comes back on, I highly suggest you try to catch this. It's the very essence of what we talk about here all the time. And it would be so great if restaurants took a fresher approach to their food. I think this was unique. And again, you know, BBC, always doing something cool. So having some beer here. The beer we're having on today's show is Le Merle from North Coast Brewing in Fort Bragg. It's here in California. It's a Belgian farmhouse Saison, 7.9% ABV. Saison, as you well know, one of my favorite styles because it's usually like a golden ale with more fruity flavors, sometimes more funky flavors. Some saisons like Saison DuPont or Fantôme will have a little wild yeast in there to bring different flavors to the table. The saison style, the reason why I like it so much, is really one of the most wide open to interpretation styles. So there's a lot of latitude for brewers to just kind of do whatever they like with it. Now I poured it here, and it's a little orange color, not really that clear, kind of cloudy. Smells really good. It looks really good for a Saison. I mean, I like Saisons around this, not, you know, super clear. Like a golden ale is always bright yellow. This is a little deeper than that. Nice thick head. Smells very Belgian. A little fruity. I'm not sure if the apricots or what. I don't know. My nose is really off right now on this stuff. I can't smell a damn thing. I can't get anything right. But the flavor is super fruity and not citrusy, but more like apricots and peaches and stuff. And I love it. I'm going to have some more. I could drink this all night. I'm telling you, it doesn't taste alcoholic. It's like 8%, right? But it's masked. So you don't know it's 8%. It could really get you in trouble if you drank a buttload of it. I'm going to be sipping this one all night as we do the show. Really easy to drink. It's part of North Coast Brewing's American Artisan Series. Brother Thelonious. That was the other beer that they had, part of this series. I think I sent a bottle of that to Should I Drink That? I don't think they liked it, though. But they thought it was okay. I can't remember. Well, listen, while I'm speaking about beer, I want to share something exciting with you guys. My friends Rick and Peter at Odonata Beer Company up in the Sacramento area, they've got really something really cool going on. Their very first beer, Rory's Ale, Batch 1, was ranked 90th on Rate Beer's Top 100 Beers of the World. To give you an idea of how cool that is, to even be on that list, there are 110,000 beers listed on Rate Beer. 9,600 breweries on Rate Beer. For them to make the top 100 out of 110,000 beers, that's phenomenal. I mean, that is really kicking some ass. I've said it before, and not just because they're my friends. You got to look out for these guys. Odonata is going to be perched high above everybody one day. Peter and Rick, they can flat out make beer anyway. But Peter treats making beer like brain surgery. The guy is a freaking artist, a craftsman. Just flat out gets it done. He makes sour beers, uses wild yeast, other strains. They're like a work of art. I say it all the time to people who tell me they don't like sour beers. I say, try Peter's. It's a shame it's not available everywhere. Maybe someday it will be. And then everyone will know. He works sour beers in a way that nobody can. Turns you around on the style. He gave me a growler once. He made a Hefeweizen that he had brewed, and he funked it up with Brett. And it was so damn good, I couldn't stop drinking it. You know what I thought? I thought, this is like a Berliner Weiss with balls. Because, you know, Berliner Weiss is kind of, I don't know, always very light and petulant. You can pretty much, you can, like, a lot of people put fruit juice in it to make it taste better. This was, it had the lightness of Berliner Weiss, but some depth. Anyway, congratulations, Peter and Rick, man. Well deserved. I can't wait to see where this is going to go for them. All right, so get this. A South Beach Burger King is about to become the first fast food restaurant in the country to offer customers beer with their food. Burger King is going to serve beer. Oh, wait, though. There's a catch. Starting in mid-February, customers will be able to order Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors products for $4.25 a bottle or get a beer with their $8 Whopper combo meal. Yeah. The move is an attempt to follow trends in the industry which show the average restaurant goer is getting older. Now listen, man, if you want to face some facts here, the average Burger King customer is getting older because it's getting cheaper to eat Burger King than it is to just go out to dinner. People are poor. This is like part of the economic struggle we're facing. People are used to going out to dinner, right? But a Whopper is like, the Whopper meal is $8. That's cheap. I mean, you can't eat out for that at a restaurant. So they're thinking, oh, we'll serve you beer, it'll make it seem more like a restaurant than, you know, fast food. But still, for two people, that's $16. All right, so think about this. $16. You know what kind of a dinner you can put on the table for $16? You get two decent steaks, a couple potatoes, some fresh asparagus, broccoli, spinach, maybe you make a salad. Far healthier, far more delicious, and you don't have to eat out of a bag. And then they're going to insult you by serving you weak piss on top of that. Burger King and Budweiser, man, that is fitting. They deserve each other. They really do. I'm glad it's come down to this, really. There's two companies that make inferior products, full of filler, weak-assed ingredients, just bad. But listen, the masses buy it, man. Keep it up, masses. You keep it sucking it up. Really good advertising. Obviously, it's working. We'll be over here eating real food, real beer. Just amazing.
Eat it before it eats you.
Ah, help me!
Okay, so listen, when I first did this back in July, man, I can't believe it's been 6 months. It's been 6 months. The first thing I should have done was shark. I only did alligator because I had it, and it was something I didn't want it to spoil. You know, Katrina bought it for me. But shark. I mean, that's the first thing people think about when they think of an animal that can and will kill you and eat you. So today we're having thresher shark. Now listen, not all sharks eat people. And a thresher shark, not really a serious threat. I mean, it could technically get crazy enough to eat you if things got nuts. But for the most part, the biggest danger you're going to get from a thresher shark is if you're surfing and it happens to swim up next to you accidentally and hit you with its tail. Because they've got rough skin and they can, you know, abrasions. But it could eat you if, like I said, if things got crazy. It is a shark, you know. I mean, sharks eat people. So because this is how we roll here on My Life as a Foodie, we're going to eat this bastard because it would probably have eaten somebody someday had we not been fortunate enough to have a fisherman snag it in a net or on a line and then slay that man killer. So let's get in the kitchen. Okay, chances are, unless you live on any coast, you will not be able to find this, or you'll have to hunt really hard to find shark meat. Out here on our coast, I see it all the time. It's not that expensive. It's about $9 to $12 a pound. It's really firm meat, cooks and tastes a lot like a swordfish steak, and the preparation is simple. Crack a little sea salt. Okay, then crack a little black pepper. All right. Now put a little olive oil on a hot grill pan or hot grill if you want to grill it outside. And toss that bastard right on there. Okay, now we'll go make some sauce for it. The steak is going to grill for about 3 minutes aside. My steak, anyway. Then we'll take it off. We'll allow it to rest for a few minutes. You want it cooked through. You don't want it pink, but you don't want it cooked too dry. You know, too well, it'll get really dry on you. If you want to know if it's cooked, here's how you do it. Take your index finger. That's the one that's closest to your thumb. All right, the one you used to pick your nose with when you were a kid. Touch that, the tip of that with the tip of your thumb, okay? Tip of your index finger, tip of your thumb. Then feel the fleshy part of your hand that's between the index finger and the thumb. Press that. You see how firm that is? That's what you want your shark steak to feel like. If it gives more than that, keep the heat on until it's done. If you want to know, you know, what the other ways are, go to the middle finger to the thumb. Feel that. Feel how weak that is. Now try your other finger, the one closest to your pinky. Now that's really delicate. That's like almost rare. So go to the index finger. That's almost firm. That's pretty much how you want your fish. If you want really good grill marks, here's another trick. Make sure you've got a really hot pan. All right. Grill it for 90 seconds on one side. Turn the fish 90 degrees. Grill it another 90 seconds. Then turn it over. Do the same thing on the other side. This is how you get those nice crisscross grill marks you see on fish. At the Red Lobster, the advertisements and stuff. So keep the heat on the pan. Once you put that fish in there, it cools the pan down. All right, so don't think about lowering the heat. Just keep your eyes on it. Don't step away from it. You know, 3 minutes, this thing's going to be cooked around that time. If you don't have shark meat, you can do this with any steak, all right? Swordfish, halibut steak, salmon, any kind of a steak cut of a fish you can do this with. And we're going to make a drunken caper sauce for this fish. It's almost as easy as actually cooking the fish. All right, so here's what we're going to need for this. 2 tablespoons of butter, 2 teaspoons of chopped fresh shallots, 2 shots of tequila, one of them's for the sauce, the other one's for you, 1 teaspoon of capers, 1/8 cup of heavy cream, and 1 sprig of chopped fresh parsley. All right, the first thing we want to do here, get the pan hot, get a nice medium-sized pan, get it hot, over medium heat, not high heat, all right, medium heat, hit it with some butter. All right, now we want to take the chopped shallots, saute these for a few minutes until they become soft and clear. You don't want anything to take on color. If at any point this butter starts to turn brown, lower the heat, all right, or take it off the heat. You don't want brown butter in this sauce. You want it white when it's finished, so be very careful. Keep your eyes on this and watch your heat. When you're cooking a fish, right, we're going to burn the hell out of the fish because the fish was evil. It deserved it. It was going to eat us, all right? Remember? It was going to kill us. But the butter's your friend, all right? So be nice to the butter. The shark, out of hell with him. All right, now we're going to take 1 shot of this tequila and toss that in the pan. Crank up the flame now here, all right? Get the stuff bubbling. Burn that alcohol off. Now while that's happening, we're going to take another shot here, and we're going to drink it. Cheers. That's good tequila. Hey, listen, I prefer drinking and cooking with silver tequilas, not gold. All right, for one thing, gold tequila in this recipe is going to change the color of our sauce, and we want this thing to be white. All right, I don't have a problem drinking gold tequila, but I don't want to cook with it in this dish, so a silver tequila would work. Now, we've cooked the alcohol off the tequila. Now we're going to add the capers. We're going to stir those in, let them saute for about a minute. Okay, let those saute. Now we'll hit it with the cream. If we get that to a nice bubble, stir it a lot, all right? Don't keep stirring. You don't want anything to stick to the bottom. Don't let it scald, and make sure everything is staying white here. Turn off the heat. Take it away from the stove. Toss in the parsley. Stir that in. And that's our sauce. We got a really nice sauce. Taste it. That's good. All right, now plate that man-killing piece of shark right on the plate here. Pour the sauce over it. Nice. There it is, Thresher shark with drunken caper sauce. Done. All right, for those of you who follow me on Twitter or Facebook, you probably know about this already. Those who didn't, here's the deal. Kat and I recently visited Gelada in Los Angeles with Peter and Joe. Gelada is a classic Southern Thai restaurant that Joe has written exhaustive posts about. I mean, she's written a lot. It's some of the most authentic Thai food that you'll taste outside of Thailand. From her posts alone, I've been dying to taste this food. I've been dying to go. I was begging her to take me there. But what got me in the door was Chef Tui's Dynamite Challenge. The Dynamite Challenge was basically made for anybody who prides themselves on eating really spicy food. You know, can you take the heat? Show me. You know, that type of thing. A dare. You know, guys do this all the time. Anyway, a lot of people talk about how much they can handle heat-wise. People don't realize there's a right and a wrong way to eat spicy food. I've had horrible experiences eating hot peppers. Some of them were straight off the vine. But there's no other way for me to really taste a pepper than if it's fresh. But if you want the full organic experience of what a pepper, you know, really has to offer, you have to eat it off the vine. But when you're cooking it, it's a little different. It's got to be really cooked slow, and the flavors have to come out, and it's a full experience. You really know exactly how hot something is when you cook with it. Gelada offered dishes prepared with the sauce made from a boot jalokia pepper, or ghost pepper. It is, without question, the hottest pepper known to man. If you look at the lead graphic for this episode on the website, you'll see a nice big orange habanero pepper. Many think the habanero is the hottest available. And it is the hottest available for pussies. If you're not a pussy, the hottest available is the ghost pepper. And on this day, Chef Tui challenged Joe and I to eat a plate of seafood and green vegetables cooked with the sauce made with the ghost pepper. And we did. We stepped up to the plate. Now, before I tell you how this went, let me tell you this. I already love Joe, all right? You guys know this. She's like a sister to me. In a little over a year, I've gotten to know this woman, and there is nothing about her that I can say I disagree with. She's the real deal. She understands me. I understand her. She's a great friend. We've built a relationship fast, and we've all made really good friends, this past year. I get her, and she gets me too. But I underestimated Joe a little bit. She can eat more heat than anybody I've ever met. Anybody. I have never seen anyone who can handle heat like this. Some friends of mine who are listening might remember this name, Lumiere. All right? I'm not going to go into details. You guys who are listening who know me for a long time, you know about Lumiere. Let me tell you something. Compared to Joe, Lumiere wears pink panties with images of Hello Kitty on them. All right? This chick eats ghost chili peppers ground up on her Cheerios, all right, for breakfast. That's the kind of person we're talking about here. I say this because she had absolutely no problems knocking back this plate of seafood when it came to our table. My plate had puddles of sauce on it. Hers looked like she'd been dipping bread in it. It was clean. And I'm getting ahead of myself now because the Dynamite Challenge kind of was the big thing. But Gelada was a really an incredible seafood experience in and of itself. Outside of the intense heat, the food was delicious. The owner of Gelada, her name is Jazz. She hired Chef Tui to bring new dishes to this place. This place had been owned by someone else prior to Jazz buying it, right? So it had been open for a while. And instead of reworking the entire menu, they kept all of the existing dishes, which appeased the customers who had been visiting Gelada for years, the regular customers. But on top of that, they added the magic of Chef Tui, who had ideas of his own. This meant that there were 200 dishes from Gelada, and Chef Tui brings in 150 more. You know how many chefs who can cook 350 different things to order? I mean, give me a break. I don't think the Rolling Stones have 350 songs to choose from when they're in concert. That's what I'm talking about here. This guy can cook in his sleep. Top of his game. Anyway, we had this thing called Morning Glory Salad. It was watercress that they deep fried it in peanut oil. Oh, it's magic. I guess there's some kind of a chemical reaction that happens when you deep fry it. It was fantastic. Then they brought this large tan lump of something. It looked like a loofah. You know what a loofah is? That spongy thing you use in the shower to wash with? It was catfish that they had ground into a paste. Then they threw it in hot oil so it exploded into a big sponge. Then when you put a bit of it in your mouth, it disintegrates like a foam or air that you have at a restaurant practicing, you know, molecular gastronomy. Magic without molecular gastronomy. Superb. There was really good rice. Sticky rice, cooling rice, aromatic rice, the kind of stuff you read about. It was nutty, chewy, perfect. If you eat something really hot, if you eat something that had some heat, eat some rice, it cools you down so you can go back. They brought this whole sea bass to our table. They covered it in this amazing aromatic sauce, lots of fresh diced peppers. This thing was beautifully deep fried, head on, tail on, perfectly cooked. Our server was pulling it off the bone with a spoon and a fork like a surgeon. If I wasn't already impressed, this would have slam dunked it. I didn't need the dynamite challenge. This was fine. The fish was perfectly cooked. It was a fresh fish. It had a sweet flavor, really intense with heat, spices, lime, ginger, aromatics I don't even know about. I can't even pick half the flavors that I tasted that day. I couldn't tell you where they came from. It was the first time I ever stared at a fish that had the head on it and had absolutely no problem thinking about eating the whole fish, including the head, the tail, the whole thing. Anyways, the dynamite challenge finally comes. It looks like this simple plate of assorted seafood with this dark curry sauce on it. It had mussels, scallops, shrimp, catfish, then Thai eggplant, green beans. It's all covered in this dense, dark brown green sauce that was cooked with the ghost pepper in it. So I ate a green bean covered in sauce. I didn't feel anything. I said, you know, that's not that hot. So Peter looks at me and he goes, dude, you wait. It'll take about, you know, 20 seconds. Give it some time. Listen, it didn't take that long. About 10 seconds later, this rush of tingling, pulsing pain shot through my tongue, right through my head. Immediately, I was in it. I had no choice. I had to keep eating. So I did. Scallops. Cooked perfectly. It was amazing how you bit into this, and it was the perfect texture. Same thing with the shrimp and the mussels. It's easy to screw up a scallop. If you cook it too long, it becomes tough and dry. If you don't cook it enough, it's slimy and chewy. This was right in the middle. And in this sauce, it tasted like the sauce. I mean, this man knows how to cook. This man knows how to cook seafood. My favorite thing on the whole plate were these mussels, because there were these big green mussels that were sweet. They had the sweet flavor. And they had this sweet, perfumey flavor that kind of kept the hot sauce from kicking me in the ass. I was really careful not to swallow too hard, right? Because if you swallow too hard or too fast, if you take a bite of this stuff, it's not the time you want something going down the wrong way and get you into a coughing fit, because then you're done. Then your throat's raw and you won't enjoy yourself. I know Jo was feeling it. She was sweating. She was really, she was roughing it, but she was eating this stuff. So she looked at me and she goes, how come you're not sweating? I didn't know why I was sweating. I felt my hair at the top of my head completely wet. Turns out I don't sweat down the side of my face. I sweat through the top of my head. So my whole head was completely wet. This was something else. This heat came in waves. It would go away. Then it would come back like a wave at the beach. Give you a big warm hug. You know, let you know it was still there. I'm still here to kick your ass. And then it would just leave and then come back. So finally I stood up. I was going to go to the restroom, right? And that's when it hit me. I was dizzy. I was experiencing this endorphin rush that ended all endorphin rushes. I've never had anything like this. And believe me, I've felt some. You know, one of the greatest things about eating really hot food is this rush of endorphins that race through your body. They give you this little high. It's a nice thing. It's a good thing. It's like runner's high. Have you ever felt that? You'll laugh, but it's no joke. When people are doing long distance running, there are these opium proteins called endorphins that run through your system to keep pain from, you know, getting to you. It's the body's way of protecting itself. Now, is it healthy? I don't know, but it feels really good. You know, sometimes we do things that just feel good. I've experienced this before when eating that pussy pepper, the habanero. It was 10 times that hot. Far better, because it had more an earthiness that I couldn't really put my finger on. I wouldn't say dirt, but it was kind of a gritty, deep flavor, where habaneros are more like fruit. I don't do drugs, okay? But I'll do this. This was awesome. The heat was great, but listen, overall, the flavors of everything on our table were so special, especially this soup they brought to us, Tom Kha, which is a coconut milk soup with a green curry, hard-boiled eggs, some bok choy or spinach or something in it. It was a crazy amount of food we had on our table. I couldn't eat any more because I was just stuffed. But we finished that dynamite challenge, and when Chef Tui came out and saw that we cleared it, he was so proud of us. Joe took a picture of me and him. I was so proud just to be in this guy's presence. It was amazing. Gelada, it's spelled J-I-T-L-A-D-A. It's in Los Angeles. You can read all about the restaurant at geladala.com. J-I-T-L-A-D-A-L-A.com. Or go to mylastbite.com. Joe has posted the hell out of this place. And she works on their website and stuff too. So it's an amazing place. Oh, and listen, some of you are going to ask me this question. I'll go ahead and tell you now. About the next day. The answer is yes. All right? I think what I told Katrina is it felt like Casper the Unfriendly Ghost Pepper was f***ing me in the ass.
Well, I was, I had a very tough night's sleep last night. For some reason, I couldn't sleep. And I think I finally fell asleep, you know, early this morning. And then the phone started buzzing. Eric Schlosser called from New York. And, you know, it was Eric's book, Fast Food Nation, that helped inspire Food Inc. And so it's been pretty nonstop. I must have gotten 100 emails so far. So it's very exciting. Hopefully it was it's a film that people seem to be very moved by, and everybody eats. So this really, this found a larger audience, and we're thrilled by that. And what's great is that it's an audience that is not necessarily, the converted. This is an audience of people who just eat food and turned out to be really interested in wanting to know where their food comes from, something that's not that easy to learn about in our country at the moment. You make films, you talk about them, and then you move on to the next. And somehow with Food Inc., it's a world that's harder to leave behind. I mean, I didn't come to this film because I was an activist. I came to it as a filmmaker, and I thought this was an interesting subject. And now, all of a sudden, you know, you're part of this large movement. People really care, and it's hard to walk away from. I don't like to eat industrial food in the same way I did before. I try to eat far less meat than I used to, but I still eat meat, but I want it to be raised organically and pastured whenever possible. But I love ethnic food. So sometimes I make exceptions and, I go to these events, and if I'm hungry, I sort of have to hide a bite every once in a while.
Okay. Here's some news I never thought I'd be reading on this show. If you're not sitting down, sit down. And if you are sitting down, stand up, then sit down. Okay. Spain's El Bulli restaurant will close in 2012 and take a 2-year break. What? Spain's El Bulli restaurant will shut down for 2 years to allow head chef Ferran Adrià to compile an encyclopedia of the recipes that have made it one of the most celebrated eateries in the world. Chef Adrià, who has turned foam into a culinary art form, told food lovers at the Madrid Fusion Gastronomic Fair on Tuesday that the 3 Michelin-starred restaurant will close its doors in 2012 and 2013 and reopen again in 2014. El Bulli was voted the world's top restaurant for the 4th year in a row last April in the S. Pellegrino World's 50 Best Restaurants 2009 compiled by Restaurant Magazine. It's fully booked for 2010, costing about $324 a person, and serving dishes like lamb's brains with sea urchins and sea grapes, detractors have branded El Bulli as pretentious and elitist. But supporters note that Adria, who has been lone head chef since 1987, has helped popularize appliances so that amateur chefs, like me, can imitate his foamy dishes on a budget at home, which I do. I was shocked to read this. I mean, I know I don't even have an ice cube's chance in hell to eat there anyway, but it was weird reading that the world's greatest restaurant, at the top of their game, would just close their doors for a couple of years. I think it's risky. I think he's doing it because his brother left and he needs to rethink things. Who knows? He may not even be back. But whatever. Adria is a creative man. The anticipation of his restaurant reopening will be overwhelming. What this does is open the door for Fat Duck to kick some ass and get that number one spot back. And the French Laundry can bank a push too. It's good for restaurants, I think. This is like if the Yankees were to clear their roster, ditch A-Rod, Petit, Cabrera, Jeter, all those dudes, all right, and just start over. That's what this would be like. Give everybody a chance. Steinbrenner always knew where to throw his money. I think Adria knows what he's doing here. It's just kind of interesting to see someone, you know, who's been dominating for so long just kind of close his doors and take a break. Okay, I know I've mentioned this film here before. Right around the time we were talking about King Korn, I think. But listener Steve brought this to my attention again. Thank you, Steve. It's on Hulu now. It's this documentary. It's called The Future of Food. And it's obviously, you know, not as polished as Food, Inc., but it brings a lot of the same issues to the table, and it's worth the time to watch. I'm going to place a link of the movie on the website. You guys can check it out. And here's a little audio from the movie. It'll kind of wet your whistle, let you know what it's like.
We used to be a nation of farmers, but now it's less than 2% of the population in the United States. And so a lot of us don't know what it takes to grow food.
Over 12,000 years ago, people began planting and saving seed. Agriculture flowered, and civilizations were born. In China, thousands of varieties of rice were grown. Over 5,000 kinds of potatoes were cultivated worldwide. In the US alone, more than 7,000 varieties of apples were grown in the 19th century. In the 20th century, the face of farming underwent a radical change. The manufacture of nitrogen-based bombs during World War I led to the development of nitrogen-based chemical fertilizers. Nerve gas, developed during World War II, was slightly modified to make insecticides. DDT was the hero of its generation. New technologies promised higher yields, increased food production, cheaper prices, and greater availability. By the mid-20th century, these technologies, along with new developments in plant breeding, led to the Green Revolution.
I think the people who first imagined the Green Revolution had good hearts. Lots of people are starving around the planet. That's long been the case in human civilization. Their thinking was if we could just systematize agriculture like we did industry in the 1800s and bring it worldwide, bring one system that works, we can solve the problems that people have long had with agriculture.
The next several decades saw a remarkable increase in production. Year after year, huge fields were planted with only one variety of crop. These monocultures created an ecological vacuum that insects and disease could exploit. This uniformity has led to some of the greatest agricultural catastrophes of mankind. In the mid-1800s, very few varieties of potatoes were cultivated in Ireland. When they became diseased, 1 million people died. When the same potato blight attacked Peru, they suffered fewer consequences.
Thanks again to Steve for bringing this up. Again, it's not another Food, Inc., all right, in terms of quality. It's not as sexy. It's not as well written. but it might be the kind of movie that inspired it or movies like it. Also, I'm watching this old episode of A Cook's Tour, Dining with Geishas, when he goes to Japan. Bourdain said something in this episode that resonated with me a little bit. And as I look back on these old shows, maybe this was where I kind of got me started thinking about eating local, staying local, concentrating on that. What Bourdain basically said in this episode was that any great cuisine grew up around the idea of using whatever is local. American culinary traditions have always been to make the food taste the same in L.A. as it does in New York, and that has hurt us. We've got a lot of good food, but we are afraid to show local pride. But that's what makes great food great. In Japan, Vietnam, Thailand, and other countries, it's something from the neighborhood. All right, because if you went 200 miles up the highway, you'll taste something different than what you might taste here. Like the food we eat at Jalata. It's southern Thai cuisine. Go to northern Thailand, mind you, not a big country, but go to northern Thailand, you'll eat things that aren't like this at all. At first I thought, you know, maybe this is something unique for Japan because it's such a small country relative to the U.S., but then I think, no, that's not true. In fact, it should be an indication to us that perhaps we have not been proud enough in the states that we live in our food. Every state's got one thing they're proud of, right? At least one thing. In New York, it's probably pizza. In Chicago, it's the hot dog, maybe pizza. In Nebraska, they've got the runza. New Orleans got crawfish, po' boy sandwiches, shellfish, right? Like the soft shell crabs. In California, I'm not sure what we have here in California we can call our own. I'd like to say the California roll, but I think we stole that from the Japanese, called it something else. But as big as these states are, we don't have enough regional cuisine. You know, we've got barbecue in the South, but there's a lot of barbecue everywhere. We've got one thing that stands out per area. We haven't branched out enough, I think. This is why it's important for us to have restaurants and chefs who bring something new and exciting to the table that are only available here. The only question is, can we call it our own? I'd like to think we could. I'd like to think that the food landscape is changing for us now, and that we've got a brighter future now because we've got chefs who are starting to think differently and take pride in the dishes that they create. But I will tell you this about California. We produce a lot of what the rest of the U.S. consumes on a regular basis. Katrina sent me this article called Food for Thought, and I found it really interesting. Farmers and ranchers in California produce more than 400 different commodities, each with its own nutritional merits. Now, everyone's into health now. Health awareness, all-time high. People realize that what they eat has a big impact on their health. They listed 10 California famous foods that have tremendous health benefits that go beyond just basic nutrition. Almonds. This is something we see all the time. We drive into Northern California, we see almond trees. The world's crazy about almonds. California? 6,000 almond farmers produce more than three-quarters of the entire crop in the world. Three-quarters of the world's crop right here in California. Salmon. Commercial harvest of California Chinook salmon began in the early 1850s. They had 100 pounders that they netted from the Sacramento River that fed hungry gold miners. Whole grains. Durum wheat, California specialty, makes great pasta. Hard red winter wheat from the Midwest is more suitable for bread. Spinach takes 39 to 48 days to grow to the harvest stage, depending on the weather and the variety. California is the nation's number one spinach producer. We produce mushrooms, yogurt, olive oil. California farmers grow 100-plus varieties of olives just for olive oil. Broccoli. Broccoli wasn't even widely known in the U.S. before the 1920s. These Italian immigrants, my people, here in California, began growing it commercially. Broccoli Rob, you've ever heard of that? They started growing broccoli. Tomatoes, blueberries. We grow a lot of things here. I see it fresh all the time. When it's in season, I see it. There's a ton to be had. It's not that expensive. It really is easy to eat right on a budget. It's not that difficult. You don't have to spend $16 at Burger King for dinner for two. You can do it right. You can do it at home. It's romantic. You don't have to go far to get to the bedroom, if you know what I'm talking about. Hey, I got mail. Some emails from listeners and stuff. And I don't get a chance to read a lot of these. I haven't get some hate mail, though. And it's okay. You know, some people had a problem with the way I was talking about the girl from McDonald's last time. And McDonald's in general. You know, people think I'm mean. One person said that, you know, for somebody who talks about they don't like bullies, that I seem to be like a bully. Yeah, I'm sorry you feel that way. And just so you know, I threw your email in the trash. And as Peter said, you can turn it off anytime. You don't have to listen to my show. Okay, Dan from Baltimore writes, hey, Phil, I know you've got a real hard-on for fast food restaurants like McDonald's and Burger King. So I'm going to tell you something. I'm really fed up with the counter jockeys that work at these places who keep telling me, sorry about your weight. Who the hell are these people to point this out? Don't they know I have feelings, or do they think because I'm fat, I have thick skin? Yeah, Dan, I think they're talking about the wait in the restaurant. Sorry you had to wait so long. Not about your wait. Okay, Connie from Branson, Missouri wrote to us, I've been a strict vegetarian for moral reasons for the last 20 years. However, I've recently gotten a serious craving for Kentucky Fried Chicken. Would it be ethical for me to eat a chicken leg if, for example, the chicken lost its leg in a chicken fight or through other natural causes? What do you think about this? Yeah, Connie, I don't think that they lose their legs in chicken fights, so you should just go ahead and eat the chicken if you want. Okay, Nathan from Phoenix, he wrote in, yo, Phil, before these PETA nuts and animal activists start complaining about elephants being forced to dance and perform tricks at the circus, they should really think about the poor elephants roaming the plains of Africa bored shitless because they've got nothing to do. Yeah, Nathan, that's a... You know, you make a good point. It's not about food, but yeah, PETA's crazy. All right, listen, that's mailbag. Damn, you people really worry me sometimes. I appreciate you writing in, but that's a little nuts. You know, that's all I've got this week. Thank you guys for tuning in. Next episode, I hope to have Bobby Bogner back on the show, talk about a show, Food Tech. Maybe we can get him to answer some of your questions. I've got some emails already from some of you, some comments on the blog. If you've got more questions for Bobby, you can send them to me at phil@mylifeasafoodie.com. I'll make sure I read them, get them answered here on the show. Any questions you might have about a show, Food Tech, it's on Thursdays on the History Channel. I encourage you guys to watch it. Music in this episode from Sick Puppies. If you like the song, download it in the iTunes store. Check the link on our website, mylifeasafoodie.com. We'll take you right there. You can buy it. Thanks again to CNN for the audio. Thank you for listening. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you next time. Define your meaning of war. To me, it's what we do when we're bored. I feel the heat coming off of the blacktop, and it makes me want it more. Because I'm hyped up out of control. If it's a fight, I'm ready to go. I wouldn't put my money on the other guy if you know what I know that I know. Like another all the same, but don't